Seems a long time ago since we last met, and you may recall, those who were here, that we had considered in some detail Luke chapter 6 and the section concerning the man with a withered hand. The comparative references were in Luke chapter 6, Mark chapter 3, and Matthew chapter 12. And we left you to contemplate, by way of your own sort of studies and homework, as it were, whether this man was genuine in coming to the Lord to be healed, or whether, to quote a phrase, it was a put-up job by the scribes, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees. In other words, was he planted there to see whether the Master would cure on the Sabbath day? Because we have seen on many occasions this Sabbath day controversy had become a real bee in the bonnet of the Pharisees and Sadducees. It was one way where they thought they might accuse him, discredit him before the people, and therefore they could get rid of this man. And time again, it's almost as if deliberately the Master were doing things on the Sabbath day to provoke their reaction. And we left you to contemplate whether or not this man was genuine or whether or not he had been planted there. We gave one or two reasons as to it could be either way, but I feel perhaps the clincher is in the first book of Kings in chapter 13. The argument against that he had been planted there was the fact that nobody without faith could be healed. And therefore, if thy faith will save thee, as is often repeated throughout the ministry of the Lord, then this man must have had the faith, he must have had the desire to be cured, otherwise the miracle would not have taken place. And that's the main argument against this man being imposed upon the situation. Well, I believe in 1 Kings chapter 13 we have almost an identical miracle being performed, and I'm going to suggest that if the basis of the healing of the man with the withered hand is against 1 Kings 13, then we'll have to think again regarding whether only faith can cure a person. It's the time when it was... we're not told who the name of the prophet was. We're told that there was a man of God who'd came out of Judah and prophesied against Jeroboam and told him that a man would be born, Josiah by name, and he would get rid of all the abominations and all the idol worship which was abundant in the land at that time. And there was going to be a sign given to Jeroboam, as in verse 3, that the altar would be rent and the ashes would be poured out. And this was going to be the sign to him that the word of God was true and that it would be fulfilled. Don't forget, this was 350 years before it came to pass. It was going to be 350 years later that Josiah was born. So we are talking about a fairly lengthy time to elapse before the prophecy was fulfilled. Anyway, in verse 4, when King Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar in Bethel, that he put forth his hand from the altar, saying, lay hold on him. He wanted to take hold of the man of God for saying such things against him. And immediately when he put forth his hands, it dried up. It became withered. It became paralyzed. And then, in accordance with the word of the man of God, the altar was rent, the ashes were poured out, as a testimony to the fact that what the man of God had said would come to pass. But then in verse 6, we find that King Jeroboam answered and said unto the man of God, entreat now the face of the Lord thy God, and pray for me, that my hand may be restored me again. And the man of God besought the Lord, and the king's hand was restored him again, and became it as before. Now I would suggest that Jeroboam was by no means a faithful man. By no means was this an act of faith on his behalf. It was demonstrating to him the power of God, that God could not only cause the hand to wither, he could all restore it to him whole. We've got a similar principle back in the Old Testament scriptures when leprous hand was made and then cleansed and so on and so forth. We know the incidents. And therefore it was not an act of faith which caused this man to be cured. And I would suggest, therefore, it is not necessarily faith on the behalf of the individual for a miracle to happen. It could be to demonstrate the power of God, and therefore was used for a purpose. Actually, at is 1 Kings. So it was demonstrating the power of God to heal, not underlining the faith on the man who was cured. It's interesting that in verse 7, Jeroboam wants to give this man of God a reward. He wants to extend hospitality to him. And he refuses. He would not have fellowship or anything to do with King Jeroboam. And so he goes on his way towards Bethel. The man of God would not fellowship with the evil King Jeroboam. Although he was prepared, because it was in the purpose of God to demonstrate the power of God to this king, he was not willing to share fellowship and extend hospitality to him. Therefore, not of necessity does it mean that a man has to demonstrate faith to be cured. It could be for another reason, to enhance the purpose of God. And therefore, when we come back to the gospel record, the fact that the man of God was cured would demonstrate the fact that the master was prepared to do good on the Sabbath day, which Luke chapter 6 verse 9 says, and therefore he was demonstrating to them that he was not concerned about their thoughts of the Sabbath. He wanted to show that he was Lord of the Sabbath, as we've looked at in another context. So that's my reasons, and maybe we'd like to discuss it later, that I do believe that this man with a withered hand was a put-up job. That he'd been planted by the Pharisees and the Sadducees to try and provoke the controversy yet again of whether the master would heal on the Sabbath day. So we now want to move on to Luke chapter 6 and verse 12, because no doubt you've come to the same conclusion in your homework and your research. Luke chapter 6 and verse 12. It came to pass in those days that he went out into a mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. That was the next incident following on from the man with the withered hand. The reason it would seem that he went into the mountain to pray was that on the very next day, verses 13 to 16, he was to choose his 12 apostles. And therefore he was communing with his father regarding the selection out of all the disciples and all the followers, which obviously he'd been with him from the beginning. He was now to choose 12 men. Now, if you'd like to make a note of the comparative references, Luke chapter 6, as we've seen, verses 13 to 16, Matthew chapter 10, verses 2 to 4, Mark chapter 3, verses 13 to 19. Luke 6, 13 to 16, Matthew 10, 2 to 4, Mark 3, 13 to 19. Those are the comparative references where the master selects his disciples, his 12 apostles. We looked at those in great detail at the beginning of our study of the life of the Lord, therefore I don't propose to repeat it. We then move on to verse 17 of Luke chapter 6, that after choosing the disciples, he came down with them, so now the 12 selected apostles were with him, and had been designated as such, and therefore all the people knew who the chosen 12 were, and they stood in the plain, and the company of his disciples. So obviously these are in addition to the 12 apostles, because he came down with them, and now in the plain with the company of all the disciples, all his followers, and a great multitude of people out of all Judea and Jerusalem, and from the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, which came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And they that were vexed with unclean spirits, and they were healed. And the whole multitude sought to touch him, for there went virtue out of him, and he healed them all. So the entire land was affected by the interest and excitement of Jesus of Nazareth. And they came with the sick and the afflicted to be healed of him. And that healing took place. Again, for the comparative references, we've got Luke chapter 6, verse 17 to 19, Matthew chapter 12, verse 15 to 21, Mark chapter 3, verse 7 to 12. That's your comparative references. Again, as we have established, I believe Luke sets in order the chronology of the events. So that's why you will find them out of sequence in the other Gospels for various reasons. But it's now in sequence that we have come to the point when the Master was to heal so many people as he was gathered in the plain. I'd like to now go to Mark chapter 3. Because although Luke doesn't provide us with this additional detail, Mark does. We take verse 7 of Mark chapter 3 so that we got the context the same. Jesus withdrew himself with his disciples to the sea, and a great multitude from Galilee followed him, and from Judea, and from Jerusalem, from Idumea, from beyond Jordan. And they about Tyre and Sidon, a great multitude, when they heard what great things he did, came unto him. In verse 10, he healed many, insomuch that they pressed upon him for to touch him, as many as had plagues. And unclean spirits, when they saw him, fell down before him and cried, "Thou art the Son of God." And he straightly charged them that they should not make this known. Mark then adds that he, at that time he went up into the mountain and calls his 12 apostles. I believe it was the other way round, as Luke gives us the chronological order. But the point which we've missed is in verse 9. And neither Matthew nor Luke records verse 9. And he spake to his disciples that a small ship should wait on him because of the multitude, lest they should throng him. And the way I interpret that, brothers and sisters, and you might have your own thoughts, is that in the midst of this great healing, he wasn't there solely for acts of healing. He wasn't there solely for miracles to be formed. He didn't want them to come to him solely to be healed. He wanted to use the healing to demonstrate by signs and wonders the message that he was preaching. But all they seemed to be interested in, quite naturally, was for the healing power to be shown. And it would seem, therefore, that he asked the disciples to arrange a boat so that he could just go away from the shore and use it, as it were, as a speaking platform. So away from the multitude who were obviously thronging upon him, wanting to touch him, wanting to receive power from him, he distances himself just for a moment in this boat, and therefore with the gap of the sea between him, he could then preach unto the people. I don't think this was just simply a healing time. He would also get his message over. And it would seem to indicate to me, because I can't see any other reason, Mark would make the point, lest they should throng him, unless he was trying to get a message across to them, and he was finding it impossible because they were all clambering to be healed. Therefore he wanted to go in a small ship to preach unto them. But you'll notice, after he healed, in verse 12, he straightly charged them that they should not make him known. Again, no publicity. He didn't want it noised abroad. On many occasions, this was the fact. Tell no man. Go, show thyself to the priest. Don't make a song and dance about it. As if he wanted to make sure that it was the message more than the miracles which was important to them. And again, he didn't want any publicity. But if we go on to Matthew's Gospel now, and chapter 12, Matthew adds another little bit which the other two Gospels don't mention. And that's in Matthew chapter 12. And we'll read from verse 15. When Jesus knew it, he withdrew himself from thence, and great multitude followed him, and he healed them. And he charged them that they should not make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, Behold my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and a smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory, and in his name shall the Gentiles trust. Matthew adds that comment, which neither Mark nor Luke does, that what the Master was doing at that time is fulfilling part of that prophecy of Isaiah chapter 42. Now the interesting thing about this, as far as I'm concerned, is it would seem to be a prophecy concerning the Gentiles. I will show judgment to the Gentiles. In his name shall the Gentiles trust. And it was at the time when he was curing all the diseased in Israel, and he was speaking unto them concerning, no doubt, the kingdom of God. If you look at Isaiah chapter 42, I don't know if any of you have compared this before, but the quotation, whereas similar, is not exact. There are differences in the actual words used, quoted in Matthew chapter 12, as compared to Isaiah chapter 42. And if you want to analyse them later, you will see that there's quite a considerable difference. Neither is Matthew chapter 12 a quotation from the Septuagint version, because that's different from what we've got in Matthew chapter 12. And there is no translation that I've been able to find which the Master was quoting. One would assume that if he wasn't going verbatim from the Hebrew, he would be quoting the Septuagint version. Neither of them coincide with what the Master is actually saying. It's almost if he's paraphrasing Isaiah chapter 42 and not directly quoting. Either that, or Matthew himself is using a generalization of Isaiah 42 and not an exact quotation, that he's saying that it might be fulfilled. Or thirdly, brothers and sisters, and this is what I personally believe, if you look at verse 17 of Matthew chapter 12, you'll notice that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, not written. Now Isaiah 42 is what's written by Isaiah the prophet, not necessarily what was spoken at that time. Now the reason I say that is, if you go to Matthew chapter 27, when we have the account of how Judas had been paid 30 pieces of silver, and with it they bought the field of blood, the potter's field, in verse 9 of Matthew chapter 27, then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, And they took 30 pieces of silver, the price of him that was valued, whom they of the children of Israel did value. Now we know that what was said in verse 9 was actually written in the prophecy of Zechariah and chapter 11. It never is found in the prophecy of Jeremiah. And critics have picked this up by saying the Lord got it wrong. Now obviously he didn't. What he is saying is, it'd been spoken by Jeremiah the prophet. He wasn't saying it was written in the prophecy of Jeremiah. It had been obviously written by Zechariah as a quote from Jeremiah. So there is a difference between when he says it is written as compared to when it is spoken. As if he has taken the essence by divine inspiration of what actually Isaiah had said rather than what was written down in the scriptures of truth. But if we can go back to Isaiah 42, brothers and sisters. Obviously Isaiah chapter 42 is the part of the suffering servant prophecy which ends in Isaiah 53, which is well known to us, and it's obviously a reference to the fact of the Lord Jesus Christ as the servant of God whom he upheld, mine elect in whom my soul delighted. I don't think we have any problem with that, you know, even from the time of his baptism, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Remember Philippians chapter 2, which we've got a quotation in the centre margin of our Bibles, he took upon himself the form of a servant. So in order to fulfil the prophecies of Isaiah concerning that suffering one who was to come, the master willingly became a servant. And he used this example to the disciples, and that was what caused the Father to be so pleased with him. I will put my spirit upon him. Obviously we know that the spirit remained upon him. But then at the end of verse 1, he shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. And the idea behind judgment is not that he was passing judgment, but he was bringing to the Gentiles the principle of God's dealings with men and women. In other words, he was going to bring the offer of salvation to the Gentiles. But he was not going to do it for a time, because verse 2 goes on to say, he shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. Is that a reference, brothers and sisters, in the context of which this is quoted, to no publicity? He was not shouting it from the housetops. He was not making a song and dance about what he was doing. He was going about the business of a suffering servant, brothers and sisters, without crying, without lifting up his voice to be heard. He wanted to get the message across in the way that he did. And therefore I would suggest that verse 2 is interpreted against the background that he charged them that they should not make him known. Then verse 3, a bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax shall he not quench. And again I would make the suggestion that the idea of the bruised reed and the smoking flax is representative of the spiritual condition of Israel at that time. They were a bruised reed, margin, they were a dimly burning flax. But they would not be extinguished totally until he brings forth judgment unto truth as far as the Gentiles are concerned. In other words, it would be necessary in the purpose of God for the Gentiles to have the opportunity to accept that which Israel rejected. And it would only be then that Israel would be extinguished. So the bruised reed would not break totally. The dimly burning flax would not finally go out until the Gentiles received the opportunity of the truth of God's word. Verse 4, we'll miss out the first phrase, till he hath said judgment in the earth, not the judgment of bringing down judgment, but the judgment in the sense of providing the Gentiles the opportunity of accepting or rejecting divine truth. and the isle shall wait for his law. So Israel in verse 3 would not be extinguished until the Gentiles had the opportunity of accepting truth. Now that's precisely what's happened. Because in the purpose of God, although the Master was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, the apostles took up the work of the Master to give the opportunity to the Gentiles to accept that which Israel had rejected before Israel were extinguished as a nation. Because most of the apostles' work took place prior to AD 70. And all the Gentile ecclesias were established and the truth was accepted by the Gentiles, and in his name the Gentiles came to trust before Israel was finally extinguished in AD 70. But you'll notice the beginning of verse 4. He shall not fail, nor be discouraged. Now when you come and look at Matthew chapter 12 and verse 20 and 21, that phrase is omitted. It's not there at all, not even by different words than that. The whole phrase is not included in that which was spoken by Isaiah. Two things to ponder. Why does the Master, or why does Matthew's Gospel leave it out? And secondly, what's the understanding of it in the context of Isaiah chapter 42 and verse 4? Now if you notice in the margin, by the word discouraged, you would see it's broken. And the he is obviously the one who is doing the work, the servant of verse 1. So it's saying he shall not fail nor be broken until he hath said judgment in the earth, until the Gentiles have the opportunity of accepting that which Israel rejected. And therefore, when we come back to the Gospel of Luke and chapter 6, and in verse 17, when he begins to give us a description of all those who came, notice it's not only Judea and Jerusalem, but from the sea coasts of Tyre and Sidon, who also come to hear him. And is the Master, therefore, preparing the way, as we saw when the Greeks came to him later on, when Philip wanted to know what to do with them, that he was preparing the way for the Gentiles to accept the truth. Although his mission was to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, that he was including the fact that the work was to continue to the Gentiles, and he himself would not be broken, would not die, until that work had been set in motion, which was going to then be completed by the apostles. That's how I would understand verse 4 of Isaiah 42. It's irrelevant as far as Matthew chapter 12 is concerned, because he doesn't mention it. It's not included. So we obviously are not supposed to understand what the Master is doing at the time with that phrase. Because in verse 20 of Matthew chapter 12, a bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench, which I believe is the attitude or the spiritual condition of Israel, until he set forth judgment unto victory, and in his name shall the Gentiles trust. I think verse 21 gives us the understanding of what sending forth judgment unto victory is. And therefore it was the Gentiles who would accept what Israel rejected. But they would continue until the Gentiles received the message. But the fact that it is quoted in the context of him healing so great a multitude would seem to indicate to me that amongst that multitude there were Gentiles there as well, so that he was no respecter of persons, that he was not discriminating, and he was setting in motion the great principle that Gentiles were included in the whole purpose of God. Anyway, that's for you to think about as well. Coming back to Luke chapter 6 now. We then, in verse 20, have the sermon on the mount, but it's not on the mount, it's in the plain. Now, I believe that this is a different time period, as I suggested to you, when we dealt with the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, 6 and 7, that this is almost a repetition by way of emphasis of what the Master had given to his disciples in the mountain. This was now to the whole multitude gathered there who had been cured and had been healed of their diseases. And although Luke only gives us a précis, it obviously seems to be almost a repetition on the Sermon on the Mount. Luke gives us four woes and four blessings. The four blessings come first in verse 20 to 22, when he says, "Blessed are the poor, blessed are ye that hunger, blessed are ye that weep, blessed are ye when men shall hate you." In direct contrast to that, instead of the poor, in verse 24, woe unto them that are rich. Instead of those who are hungered for righteousness' sake, he says in verse 25, woe unto them that are full. To those who weep now, woe unto you that laugh now, verse 25. And blessed are those when men shall hate you, he says in verse 26, woe unto them when they speak well of you. So what he's doing, out of all the things that he said in the Sermon on the Mount, he's now repeating, but he's emphasising the contrast. He selects four to show the right and the wrong. And he uses the same analogies to say how you should be poor in spirit or rich as far as this world is concerned, and so on and so forth. I think we spent plenty of time in discussing these things when we did the Sermon on the Mount, so I'm not proposing, brothers and sisters, to repeat it. I think we included most of the principles from verse 20 and so on and so forth. I think we spent plenty of time in discussing these things when we did the Sermon on the Mount, so I'm not proposing, brothers and sisters, to repeat it. I think we included most of the principles from verse 20 through to the end of this chapter in our discussions of Matthew's chapters 5, 6 and 7. So by way of reference, I'm sure you've got your notes, or I'm sure Charles will let you have the tapes if you want to listen to them again. So Luke chapter 6 from verse 20 to the end of the chapter is now the Sermon on the Plain. Which means that after he had ended all these sayings in Luke chapter 7 and verse 1, we get the next miracle. And that's the miracle of the healing of the centurion's servant. For the comparative references again, because we shall be going backwards and forwards, it's in Luke chapter 7 verse 1 to 10 and Matthew chapter 8 verses 5 to 10. To 13. It is not in Mark's account. It's Luke chapter 7 verses 1 and 10, 1 to 10, and Matthew chapter 8 verses 5 to 13. Mark doesn't mention the healing of the centurion servant. If I've been permitted to read, or have read, verses 1 to 10 of Luke, so that we may just familiarize ourselves with the context. Brother Graham, would you mind reading Luke chapter 7, verses 1 to 10? Right, I'm always accused of sort of waiting till the very end to make a suggestion as to who the various person was being referred to. I'm going to come up front this time, and then hopefully during the course you might be able to prove it or disprove it for yourself. I believe the centurion was Cornelius. And I think we'll be able to demonstrate it was Cornelius by the time we've ended the discussion on the miracle here. And I have no doubt in my own mind, I'm totally convinced, unless somebody can prove it otherwise, that it's Cornelius. So I've been upfront, so I can't be accused by my wife after of sort of keeping it to the end. Right. Now, we're not told in Luke's Gospel much about the actual disease that the centurion's servant had. We are told a bit more in Matthew's. Because if you go back to Matthew chapter 8, and again, it's significant that Matthew puts it one of these earliest miracles. When in chronological order, many had taken place by this time. But Matthew is obviously emphasising the kingly aspect of the Master, and therefore he gets the miracles and the ministry of the Lord in a different order to the actual chronology. But it comes early on, and in verse 6 of Matthew chapter 8, the centurion says about his servant, "Lord, my servant lieth at home, sick of the palsy, grievously tormented." Now, I'm not a medical expert at all, don't profess to know anything about it. But again, it is unusual for someone who's to paralyzed, because we've had other people who've been paralyzed, you know, somebody who's had the palsy before and was cured, to be actually grievously tormented. But this idea is he keeps having muscle spasms and he's in terrible agony because of these muscle spasms. That's the idea behind verse 6. And some experts have suggested that he'd got tetanus. Now, I always assumed tetanus meant you got locked jaw, because when you were sort of given a jab, when you cut yourself, apparently, you know, I always thought it was a tetanus jab for locked jaw. But apparently, and Sue turned it up in a medical dictionary, that any open wound can get the disease of tetanus and it causes a paralysis, and it can be anywhere. But the main thing about it, you get terrible pain with it. It's a fact. And therefore the description that he was paralysed but he was in absolute agony would seem to indicate that possibly he'd just fallen over, cut himself, the disease had entered into him, there was no injections for it in those days, and within a matter of a short space of time he was not only paralysed but he was in absolute agony. So this doesn't seem as if it was a long illness, that he hadn't been paralysed from birth or anything like that. The suggestion is this was fairly new experience for him, and the centurion, who obviously felt a lot for his servant, wanted something to be done. Whilst you're in Matthew, you'll notice in verse 5 that Matthew says the centurion came to him, beseeching him. Whereas you'll notice when Graham read it in Luke chapter 7, it was the elders of the Jews who came to him. So one had got to be right, one had got to be wrong. Now I would suggest that both are right. That it was the centurion who obviously wanted to beseech the Lord, but the elders actually did the work for him. Now, again, that's not unusual, because if you look at Mark's Gospel in chapter 10, Mark's Gospel chapter 10 and verse 35, we hear about now James and John, the sons of Zebedee, saying, "Master, we would that we should thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we shall desire, and that's to sit on thy right hand and thy left." And Mark gives the indication it's James and John who come. Now if you look at Matthew's Gospel in chapter 20, you will see that he tells us in verse 20, it's not them who come directly, it's his mother. And his mother is pleading for her two sons. So obviously the sons had discussed it with the mother, and therefore, as it were, it was their request, but they weren't putting it directly to the Lord, the mother was acting as their mediator. I'll give you another example. There's plenty of them. I'll just give you one more. John chapter 19. And perhaps we'll see it a bit easier from John chapter 19. Verse 1. Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. Now for a minute, I don't think he did it personally. I can't imagine the Roman governor literally taking the master out and picking up the whip and scourging him. He obviously delegated somebody to do it, but it was his word, his authority. He gave the order for it to be carried out. And therefore it is not unusual for someone to be the go-between to actually do something on behalf of somebody else. Now this Roman centurion acknowledged later on that he was a man having authority. He would say to this man, do this, and to the other, do the other. And therefore it would seem that although it was he who wanted the request to be made to the Lord, he got the elders of the Jews to actually do it. The elders of the Jews going to Jesus and requesting a favour of him. Can we imagine it? Can we imagine, against the background of what we have just experienced, of how with hatred they tried to trip him up? They wanted to throw the controversy of the Sabbath day law back in his face time and time and time again. And now almost, if I can use the phrase, with cap in hand, heating humble pie, they had to go and ask him a favour. What would persuade them, brothers and sisters, to do that? Someone who they had the greatest respect for, someone who had done so many favours for them, had asked for their help. How could they say to him, we don't accept this man, we don't believe in him at all, we don't think you'll do anything for your servant, he's an imposter. The noise abroad had shown that Jesus was a man who'd perform miracles. They had to accept that no man could do these miracles except God was with him. How could they say to this centurion, well, we don't think much of him. You know, as far as we're concerned, you know, he's not to be trusted. We wouldn't have anything to do with him. Because they acknowledged in verse 5 of Luke chapter 7, he loveth our nation and has built us a synagogue. He'd given much alms to the Jews. He was a lover of their nation. He'd actually built them a synagogue. So they obviously had great respect for this centurion, not only for the money that he obviously poured upon them, but the fact that he could make their lives a lot more pleasant. He was a centurion of the Roman army, and therefore he could have wielded his power against them in many and varied ways. But rather than that, he not only gave them a great respect, but he showed that he loved them by building them a synagogue. Why should he love them, brothers and sisters? Unless he was a worshipper of their God. Unless he had come to have great respect. What benefit was there to him personally as a Roman centurion to spend money in building the Jews a synagogue, to extend their worship, to love the nation in such a way? Why, brothers and sisters? The only conclusion I can come to is that he was a lover of their God, and to show his love for their God, he was prepared to do this for God's people, the Jews. Now, if you therefore, I'm not by any means saying this is conclusive yet, we're just building up a comment. In Acts chapter 10, if you could come with me there. There was a man there called Cornelius, who we're told in verse 2 was a devout man and one that feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. So it was a centurion of the Romans who was obviously favourably disposed to the Jews. He gave much to them, the reason being because he feared their God. Now, irrespective of whether you think the centurion servant at this point, was Cornelius or not, You've got to come up with the reason why this man was willing to show so much charity to the nation of Israel. Why he should build them a synagogue. And I believe because he was a worshipper of their God. And therefore they were more than willing to do him a favour. More than willing to do him a favour. Now I reckon that would have hurt. That would not have been easy for them to do. But they were willing to do it because in verse 3 of Luke chapter 7, when he heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. So the centurion was obviously, because the master went with them in verse 6, and he was on a journey. And it was when he was travelling to the centurion's house that word was sent to the master that he was not worthy for him to come into the house. So I would suggest the centurion was not a Capernaum. I would suggest, and I'll give you the reason later on, that the centurion was in Caesarea. And the master was willing to make the journey to Caesarea for the purpose of curing this man's servant. And I think we've got in the Gospels why he was on his journey to Caesarea. He never got there, but he was on the way. Apart from that, in this moment in time, verse 3, he beseeches the Jews that he would come and heal his servant. Now, two thoughts again for you to ponder. The master, knowing the thoughts of every man, would know whether the intent of the Jews, the elders of the Jews, was sincere and genuine or not. He would be able to see straight through them to see whether they were pleading, and the idea of beseeching is absolutely imploring, almost getting on their knees and begging him that he would come. That's the idea behind the phrase. And would go to the centurion's house to heal the servant. Not, we'll bring the servant here, but you would go there. Come and heal his servant. Was it total genuineness? Or were they willing, brothers and sisters, yes, to do a favour for the centurion because of what he had done for them? So they kept faith with the centurion, so they didn't lose any faith from him. But also, at the same time, there was a motive behind it. And this is the motive, Acts chapter 10 and verse 28. This is Peter, obviously, coming onto Cornelius. Verse 25 for connection. And as Peter was coming in, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. And Peter took him up, saying, stand up, I myself also am a man. And as he talked with them, he went in and found many that were come together. And he said unto them, you know how that it is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation. But God hath showed me that I should not call any man common or unclean. The fact that Cornelius, when he heard the master was coming, said, don't come into the house, I'm not worthy, was it the fact that he knew that the Jews had no dealings with the Gentiles? And that the elders wanted him to go to Cornelius because they then had got something else against him. That it was against their law, and that's what verse 28 says, for a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation. And that's precisely the words in verse 3 of Luke chapter 7. The elders of the Jews beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And therefore, brothers and sisters, I feel there is behind the pleading of the Jews a motive that if they would seem to be totally genuine, and they'd have to obviously be eating humble pie to say to the Lord, you know, we'd like you to do a favour for us. We might have misjudged you in the past, but you know, this is genuine. This man really loves our nation. Would you come to his house and cure his servant? But behind it, brothers and sisters, was the fact that if he did, not only would they save face with the centurion, but also they would have had him. Now it's interesting when we consider Roman centurions. There are a number of references to centurions in the scriptures. Every one of them is shown in a good light. Every single one of them is shown in a good light. Now you think of a Roman centurion, you know, in charge of 100 soldiers or more, you know, one of the hard soldiers of Rome. Why should they show any favours to anybody at all? And yet in the scriptures, every time a centurion is mentioned in the New Testament, they seem favourably disposed to the men of God. Let's just go through. Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23. The time of the Master's death, when the veil of the temple was to rip in two, in verse 47 of Luke chapter 23, "Now when the centurion saw what was done, he glorified God, saying, 'Certainly this was a righteous man.'" The Jews were saying, "Crucify him." The Roman centurion was saying, "This was a righteous man, and he glorified God." We see in Acts chapter 10, Cornelius, the Roman centurion. You go to Acts chapter 22. The time when Paul was obviously taken by the Jews and delivered to the Romans. And we find in verse 24, Acts 22, "The chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle and bade that he should be examined by scourging, that he might know where they cried so against him. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said unto the centurion that stood by, 'Is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned?' When the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief priest, saying, 'Take heed what thou doest, for this man is a Roman,'" and so on and so forth. Why should the centurion listen to Paul? Yeah, the chief captain had given the command. Obviously, he'd become acquainted with Paul and believed what this man said, to the point he was willing to save him from being scourged, and so it came to pass. So again, we've got someone, a centurion, speaking up on behalf of the apostle. And this again is seen in Acts chapter 27, and obviously the shipwreck took place when the soldiers in verse 42 wanted to kill all the prisoners, but in verse 43, the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from the purpose. Again, a centurion, pleasantly disposed to the apostle Paul, wanted to save him, and therefore were willing to save all the rest. Every time the centurion is shown, he's not a despot, he's not anti the truth, he's not trying to condemn it or put to death those who are speaking about the gospel, they always seem to have a character which was good. Well, that would be an interesting aside. Anyway, we come back to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 7. So when verse 4 says, "And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this, for he loveth our nation, and he hath built us a synagogue." Then in verse 6, then Jesus went with them. He was willing to go with them. If you compare Matthew's Gospel, chapter 8, verse 7, Jesus says to them, I will come. So he acknowledges he will do what they've requested. But notice what he adds according to Matthew in verse 7. I will come and heal him. I will actually cure him. Now he could obviously, brothers and sisters, have said to him, go thy way. The servant is cured. But he doesn't. He says, I will come and I will heal him. So why was he prepared to go if it wasn't for the fact that he was going along with the request of the Jews of going towards this man's house? Verse 8 of Matthew chapter 8, the centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that the shepherd is come. I think if we go back to Luke's account, chapter 7, verse 6, Luke provides us a bit more background, to which Matthew doesn't. When he was not now far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that thou shouldest enter under my roof. And again, just trying to think about it and put it into context, it obviously would seem that in verses 3, 4, 5 and 6, when the elders had beseeched him to come and come to that man's house, the centurion's house, and in verse 6 Jesus had agreed to go with him, then somebody must have been dispatched to the centurion to say, the Lord is coming, he's agreed to it, right? As if, you know, we've done our job, you know, we've shown you the favour that you asked of us, he is coming. In other words, they were almost protecting themselves. Look, you know, from now on, it's not our responsibility. You asked us to get Jesus to come to you. He is now coming. But when the centurion obviously got the message the master was coming, he didn't want that. He wanted a word from the master. He knew that was sufficient. And therefore, I would suggest that the elders had gone beyond what the centurion had asked them. The centurion asked them to go to the master and say, can you cure my servant or will you cure my servant? The elders had taken it a step further for their own purpose. Lord, will you come to help this man? He's a very good man. These are the reasons you should do it. And please come to his house. And now the centurion said, no, Lord, I don't want you to do that. I'm not worthy for you to come to my house. And then he goes on to say, and we'll come back to a few more words in a minute, but he says in verse 7 of Luke chapter 7, wherefore neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee, but say in a word, and my servant shall be healed. And I believe that's all he expected. A word from the master saying, thy servant is healed, because he goes on to say in verse 8, I also am a man having set under authority, having under me soldiers, and I say unto one, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. Now, obviously, I've always expressed to everyone, verse 8, to me, sums up every husband who has ever lived. A man under authority, they say to us, do this, and we do it, and all that sort of thing. But this man was saying, more to the point, I also have authority. That's the point. He was not under authority in one sense. He had authority. But there is another way it can be understood, brothers and sisters, and I believe that is what verse 8 is conveying. He says, I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers, and I say to one, go, and he does it. First of all, he is acknowledging that Jesus, like himself, has got authority. I also, like you, Master, have authority, but like you, Master, I am set under authority. In other words, the soldiers do what I tell them because I represent Caesar. So they're not doing it because I, the centurion Cornelius, am telling them to do it. It's because I carry the position of a Roman centurion, and it's Caesar's authority which tells me that I can say to these men, and they carry it out. If they didn't, they'd die. I haven't got that power, but Caesar has. And I have been given the position to exercise that power. So rather than saying that I've got authority, I genuinely believe he says I'm under authority. I'm under the authority of Caesar. And also, because of that authority, people do what I say. And I believe that the centurion here in verse 8 is acknowledging that Jesus was also under authority. And there was someone behind him greater than even Caesar. The God whom he himself had the greatest respect and worshipped. That he was acknowledging that Jesus had the authority of God behind him, because no man could do those miracles except God be with him. And what the Jews were failing to accept, I believe the centurion, the Gentile, was willing to accept. That the authority of Jesus had come from God, and therefore also he was set under authority. So one word from him carried the conviction and the authority of God, and therefore that was sufficient. Because when we come to Psalm 107, I believe that this man would know verses such as this. Psalm 107 and verse 19. Then they cry unto the Lord in their trouble, and he saveth them out of their distresses. He sent his word and healed them, and delivered them from their destructions. Send a word, Lord, that's all I need, and it will heal my servant. Because you also are a man under authority. You have the word of God. Send God's word and my servant will be cured. And I believe the centurion knew more about the Old Testament than sometimes we give these men credit for. And therefore, just say the word, the angels will carry out your will. Right. So can I just conclude this part, and we'll take it up next time, brothers. This is Matthew chapter 26. Verse 53, where the master before Pilate says, Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? The master could have given the word, and the angels would have carried out the will of God in curing the servant. He didn't need to be personally there to touch the man or do anything like that. The word of God was sufficient, the angels of God would have carried out the will, and the servant would have been cured. And the man understood that because he acknowledged Jesus as also being under the authority of God. And because of that position, unique as it was, then the word would be sufficient. Okay, we'll take it up next time from there. Give you time to think about and contemplate and tear me apart on these suggestions.